Good counsel. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Evans against Jeff. Mr. Jones, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court. I am here today to ask the court's assistance in restoring a valuable bargaining procedure for both plaintiffs and defendants, a procedure which has been effectively denied to civil rights litigants in the Ninth Circuit by the lower court's decision. That is the ability to negotiate attorney's fees along with all other elements of settlement in trying to secure the resolution of civil rights actions. This practical procedure, which is taken for granted in almost all other civil actions and in civil rights cases outside of the Third and Ninth Circuits, is essential to case settlement. It produces a bottom line of settlement for the defendants, but it also can be a valuable bargaining chip for the plaintiffs. In this case, the respondents waived counsel fees to obtain the benefit of a settlement which gave them, as the Ninth Circuit put it, quote, more than the district court during earlier settlement hearings had indicated it was willing to grant, unquote. However, after using the fee waiver as a bargaining chip, the respondent's attorney appealed the fee waiver and the denial without finding or even looking for an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial judge. The Court of Appeals peremptorily struck the fee waiver from the settlement agreement and in the process imposed a rule which virtually bans simultaneous negotiations of merits and fees. The underlying tone of the opinion seems to hint that defense counsel were engaged in conduct that was unseemly or unethical. However, the record reflects that this was simply not the case. Defense counsel were just doing their job within applicable ethical guidelines. They were trying to settle the case in a manner which served their client agency's program goals and at a bottom-line cost which their client could live with. Indeed, the trial judge specifically found that there had been no unethical conduct on the part of the parties. We are here because we believe the Ninth Circuit adopted an unworkable approach which will discourage settlement of these important cases. Further, the entire decision was based on the faulty premise that special settlement rules apply to civil rights fee-shifting cases. This court recently ruled in Merrick v. Chesney that no such special settlement rules exist, and therefore the lower court ruling must be reversed. This type of case presents a unique situation because both sides are generally interested in improving conditions for the plaintiff class. That is the primary reason why the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare agreed to provide more relief than the trial judge had indicated that he was going to grant. But this willingness to provide additional relief was expressly conditioned on a waiver of attorney's fees.
General Jones, do you read the Ninth Circuit's opinion as being limited to class action situations where Rule 23 would apply?
Justice Rehnquist, I read it as being applicable to all situations, not only class action cases, but all situations.
Well, what is the authority of a district court to supervise the settlement of something that isn't a class action?
Well, under Rule 16, the judge or the parties can talk about settlement, pretrial conferences, I think in that context, if somebody is being unfairly put upon, if there's unethical conduct, I think that the matter can be brought to the attention of the district judge.
I'm sure it could be brought to the attention of the district judge. The question is, what can the district judge do about it if it is brought to his attention? So supposing that A sues B in the United States District Court for the District of Idaho, it's not a class action, and the parties before trial simply file a stipulation for dismissal of the case because it's been settled. Does the district court have any authority to review that or pass judgment on it?
I wouldn't think so, Your Honor. I think the only place where the district judge really has any place in looking into a situation is where there's clearly unethical conduct. If there's not unethical conduct, if the parties are operating within the rules of the game like the people were here on both sides, I think they probably ought not to become involved in it. I think it's just been an accepted practice that the people, as long as they're acting ethically, should be able to strike their bargain and negotiate an agreement and a settlement and not have the court messing around with it and telling them, well, we don't like this.
General Jones, in the class action setting, which I guess this was, is it your position that you could ethically have offered the respondents complete relief on the merits of all their claims? Now, that wasn't what happened here. But if you had offered complete relief on all their claims, conditioned on a complete waiver of any attorney's fees, would that have been ethical?
Justice O'Connor, I think it certainly would have been ethical. I think we could have offered them less than they were entitled to and a waiver of fees. They weren't obligated to take it. There's no rule that protects them from going to court and trying their case in front of a court. And as the amicus for the other side, I think the Legal Aid Society of New York said, they were confronted with a situation where the City of New York sprung a fee waiver request along with a settlement on the merits on the eve of trial. They said, we took them to trial and creamed them. We got not only our fees but all the relief. And they have that option available to them. I think that there's
Would the situation be any different, in your view, if there had been an assignment agreement by the plaintiffs below to their attorneys assigning any and all rights to attorneys' fees under Section 1988 to the attorneys?
I don't think it should make any difference on the outcome of this case because that's a matter between the client and the attorney. What the attorney
that
is
that alter the ethical considerations at all in the propriety of making an offer of settlement?
As between the parties, I don't see that it alters the ethical ethical arrangements at all. I think the biggest part of the problem that you have in these cases is the ethical considerations between the plaintiffs and the plaintiffs' attorneys. But again, that's something that has to be resolved between them before the State Bar Association. It's not something that ought to be coming up in Rule 23 settlement considerations.
That if there are no ethical considerations, then the court shouldn't get into it. But except as you now suggest that the Bar Association might get into it later, how else would the ethical factors be flushed out? You're dealing, on the one hand, with laypersons who are the class, and a lawyer on the other hand. Is there not a disparity of understanding of the realities that calls for some kind of inquiry?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there has to be an inquiry to make sure in the settlement conference that the plaintiff class is not being put upon. That is, it's not some kind of a sweetheart deal that they're being shortchanged on their relief at the gain of the lawyers. I think that has to be looked into, but as far as the arrangements that they have for making payment of the fee, so long as they don't impinge upon the share of the agreement that goes to the class, I think you ought to leave them to their own devices. So I think that some inquiry has to be made to make sure that the rights of the class are not being impinged upon. But
would you think the situation would be any different if the class was made up entirely of minors under the age of whatever the age was of the particular state, 18 or 21. Would there be any greater obligation to protect a class of minors than a class of adults?
I think to an extent you've got to have a little greater review and make sure the settlement is being fair to the class, as the trial judge did here. The trial judge looked at it at the hearing on the settlement and said it looks as if the clients are being treated very fairly, said no unethical conduct in this case. And I think that's the type of review. The Ninth Circuit said that the judge did not conduct that kind of review, or they didn't give him credit for it, but he did. He looked at it and he said the clients were treated fairly. No unethical conduct, so he approved it. And I think that
you're not challenging then the idea that the trial judge, who's supervising the whole situation, can appropriately inquire into the fee. You don't question that then?
No, I don't question that. I'm saying that he can look into the fee, and he can look into the arrangements so far as they impinge on the class. But other than that, I don't know that there's any need to do so.
The looking into would be for the benefit of the class, I think.
Yeah, to do like the trial judge did here and say, yes, this is fair to the class. If the plaintiff's counsel took half of the relief, then I think that the trial judge should look at it very carefully. But that was not the case here, and that, I mean, we're not advocating that that should be the case.
In a rate case, for example, there have been class actions involving utility rates. There was one, whether reported accurately or not, I don't know, but the average yield to the members of the class was said to be $8.58 per person, and the lawyers got $250,000. On the face of it, that would seem shocking, but maybe they earned the $250,000 to get $8.58 average for 10 or 20 or 30,000 utility ratepayers.
I see nothing wrong with the court looking at that and saying, well, it's justifiable, we'll approve the settlement. But that's not what happened in this case. In this case, the plaintiff class got more than was entitled to in exchange for a fee waiver. The plaintiff's counsel appealed. The Ninth Circuit said, well, this is not acceptable. We can't have simultaneous negotiations of merits and fees. And they struck the fee waiver, leaving the rest of the agreement in place. And we simply don't believe that the Ninth Circuit decision, which bans contemporaneous resolution of case merits and related fees, except in unusual circumstances, can be supported either on legal or practical grounds. The rule is in conflict with this Court's holding in Merrick v. Chesney. The Ninth Circuit based the ban on a supposed congressional intent to apply special settlement rules in civil rights cases. However, Merrick makes it clear that no such special rules exist. In fact, civil rights cases are subject to the same public policy which favors settlement, and it's fairly clear from the experience in the Third Circuit and elsewhere that this ruling is directly in conflict with that policy. Some commentators are concerned that simultaneous negotiations can cause problems and soul-searching for plaintiff's counsel, but litigation in general has its share of problems, soul-searching, and heartburn for counsel for all parties. And offers of judgment, which include fees, can cause all of these same problems. Yet this Court in Merrick held that simultaneous offers of judgment are permissible and not violative of any congressional intent, and the same reasoning, the same rationale, ought to apply to simultaneous negotiations between the parties. It appears clear that the Ninth Circuit improperly interpreted the congressional intent and erroneously banned simultaneous negotiations. It was also based on this mistaken interpretation of congressional intent in Section 1988 that the Court felt it had the authority to strike the fee waiver while leaving the rest of the agreement in place. And we'd ask the Court to reverse on both grounds.
Since holding on the Rule 68 case has any impact on this situation at all?
Certainly, Your Honor, the whole underpinnings of the Court's decision was that there was some special rule that applied in civil rights cases which allowed the judge to enter an order that says, well, you don't negotiate the fee merit, portion along with the merits portion. The Court specifically said that the legislative intent gives us the ability to require bifurcated negotiations. And it's the Merritt case makes clear that that's not the case. Another ground for reversal is that the rule adopted below is an unreasonable deterrent to settlement and contrary to the strong public policy in favor of out-of-court resolutions of controversies. Bifurcated negotiations place the defendants in a quandary. If he settles, the settlement confers prevailing party status on the plaintiff, which in turn subjects the defendant to attorney's fees even in a frivolous case or a nuisance case. The present case is even more difficult because the extra relief granted by the defendant could result in greater liability for attorney's fees if the respondent were to later claim that he obtained an excellent result. If the defendant is prohibited from negotiating or even discussing fees, he can't properly evaluate settlement options. And, of course, defendant's counsel is in a quandary, too, and he's in an uncomfortable position because he can't do an adequate job of advising or counseling his client with regard to settlement.
Mr. Jones, in this case, injunctive relief were sought, but if damages were sought in a class action and the plaintiffs entered into a contingent fee agreement with their attorney, would it be appropriate for the defendants to propose settlement contingent upon giving up the contingency fee?
Well, they could probably propose that, Your Honor. But
you think that's ethical?
I suppose it's
no interference with contractual relations or anything of that kind.
I think they could propose it, but they certainly are not in a position to compel the other side to accept it. The other side could say that's clearly
how
a
does
violation
that differ
of,
from the assignment at the outset of any right to attorney's fees under Section 1988?
Well, I think, again, there's a difference because the other side is intruding into the arrangement between counsel and the party. And
would
I think
the same be said if there were a contractual assignment ahead of time of any attorney's fees rights?
Well, the other side, the defendant, is not attempting to become involved in the relations between the client and the party. I think it would be rather ineffective. I think they're in a position where they can say they'd want to do it, you know, you make whatever arrangements you want to. But I don't see that it has any real effect on the case that we have here at hand. The rule that was adopted by the Ninth Circuit doesn't take into account the defendant's need to have a bottom line for settlement. And, of course, this Court determined that was an important element both in the Merritt case and in White v. New Hampshire Department of Employment, where this Court specifically refused to adopt the rule which was adopted in this case by the Ninth Circuit.
In a typical contingent fee case where the plaintiff's lawyer is taking a case on a contingency and his fee is going to depend on how much he recovers, I suppose that the defendant could surely propose a settlement to him. Say, we'll pay your client X dollars. If that's X dollars, whereas the attorney thinks that he will make more money if it's 2X, he may turn it down. Isn't there almost the same possibility of conflict of interest in just a typical contingency arrangement?
Certainly, there's a conflict of interest any time when there's not enough money to go around between the client and his attorney, and the people have got to work those out. Those situations day after day, and I don't think it's really a problem that should be presented to this Court. Let them work it out.
Mr. Attorney General, something you said there, if there isn't enough to go around, even if there's an abundance of result to go around, the ethical problem that's argued by the Ninth Circuit is still present as between the client and the lawyer, is it not?
There's
something they have to work out between them.
The problem is always there, and they've always got to work it out between themselves. But if we get the Ninth Circuit and everybody else involved in the process, it's going to bog the courts down to a point where we won't be able to get these cases moving through the courts.
Well, in Merrick against Chesney, for example, our Rule 68 case, if the Ninth Circuit rule had applied there, would you say that there might not have been a settlement? That might have interfered with the settlement.
That's very likely the case. Those things have to be worked out between the parties and their attorneys. They shouldn't be worked out between the court. The court sets the rules and says you can offer simultaneous relief on both the merits and the fees. And I think the court has done its job. One thing that I haven't mentioned is the fact that the rule below will not allow the use of the fees as a bargaining chip. And it's an important bargaining chip. It's a chip that belongs to the plaintiff, not his attorney, and he ought to be able, the plaintiff ought to be able to use it to his advantage. This case is a prime example where additional relief was granted in exchange for that attorney fee bargaining chip. There was another case recently here in the District of Columbia in the D.C. Circuit, a 1985 decision, Moore against the National Association of Securities Dealers, and the Court of Appeals held that it was proper to bargain away fees in exchange for merits relief, and the court refused to follow the rule below or the rule in the Prandini case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. He's Tuesday. Another country lawyer type.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure require judicial approval of a settlement in a class action, but that has generally been regarded as protective of the members of the class rather than protective of attorney's fees for counsel of the class. Congress could have specified in the Civil Rights Attorneys Fees Award Statute, Section 1988 of Title 42, that reasonable attorneys' fees must be awarded in every case and that this cannot be waived in a settlement of a civil rights case. It did not so provide, but we have assumed that the contention on the other side is based on the proposition that in light of the policies behind Section 1988, that statute should be interpreted as imposing a limitation on the ability to waive or compromise fees, because otherwise, as Justice Rehnquist has suggested in his questioning, it is difficult to see any other basis on which there can be a rejection by the court of a settlement that the parties have agreed to any more than they would have been required to litigate in the first place. Now, settlement efforts usually involve the art of compromise, and we recognize that in the context of fee award statutes, settlement negotiations can present ethical difficulties for the plaintiff's counsel, not the least of which is the danger that relief for the client's substantive claims might be sacrificed in favor of a fee award. And our starting point in this case is that it should not be assumed that Congress resolved this problem or that the court should resolve it by automatically placing the fee award in the favored status in which it would be removed altogether from the settlement negotiations and the plaintiff's counsel would have nothing left to discuss compromise about except the plaintiff's substantive claims. That is resolving the ethical dilemma by elevating the attorney's fee award to a favored status. And in the absence of direction by Congress that it intended to do that, we believe that that isn't the proper resolution to be assumed. And another important perspective in this case begins with the Court's recognition last term in Merrick against Chesney that settlements would be discouraged if the defendants were unable to make offers that would extinguish their total liability, including their liability for fees, which can be a very sizable ingredient.
Pushes the ethical problem, to the extent that there is one, right on to the plaintiff and his lawyers, does it not?
Well, that is our position, Mr. Chief Justice. Now, ordinarily, in these settlement discussions, the defendants' counsel's ethical obligations, and there's more than one counsel's ethical obligations to consider here, the defendants' counsel's ethical obligation ordinarily is in negotiations to try to minimize his client's liability in whatever way he can. And what we caution against is open-ended ambiguity about the extent to which and the circumstances in which the defendant's counsel must compromise that duty to minimize his client's obligation in favor of other concerns, because that kind of ambiguity would seriously threaten the viability of the settlement process itself. And would lead to relatively routine efforts to invite judicial second-guessing of the fairness of the settlement terms. And in our experience, that kind of second-guessing really requires an inquiry which approaches a trial on the merits. And if you're going to have that kind of second-guessing, there isn't much point in trying to settle the case in the first place.
Mr. Wallace, do you suggest that Rule 23 in class actions offers no source of authority for the court to make any inquiry under any circumstances into the appropriateness of the fee waiver proposal in the settlement?
We don't go that far, Your Honor. We don't think that the arguments in this case are limited to class actions for the most part, but we do think that while Rule 23 is primarily concerned with protecting the members of the class, one possible source of concern is whether in the long run the members of the class would be deprived of opportunities to have their claims presented. And if you had a situation where there was a vindictive effort to discourage counsel from representing the members of the class, by giving them an offer that they can't refuse, contingent on waiver of fees, just to teach counsel that they'd better not bring such cases.
Do you think the circumstances in this case would be sufficient to at least enable the district court to look at it where it's made on the eve of trial and only injunctive relief was sought and the relief granted was substantial in the settlement? Is that enough to permit the district court under Rule 23 to look at it anyway at the request of the attorneys on the other side?
Well, I hate to say no, to look at it in the sense that if an allegation was properly made that came within the standard this Court adopted in Franks against Delaware, an allegation that there was something really improper here in this offer. After all, the plaintiffs were not required to accept the offer. The fact that it was the eve of trial meant that they presumably were ready to go to trial. And a settlement negotiation. Our main point is that the court really should minimize the extent of judicial cabining or intrusion or second-guessing of settlement negotiations, because it becomes a long and unedifying inquiry into who said what to whom when. And after all, the settlement is something that both sides agreed to and were not forced to agree to. Now, there are categories of cases where the choices are less difficult than they are in this kind of a class action seeking only injunctive relief where there won't be any monetary award to divide between counsel and his clients as they see fit, where the clients aren't someone who can afford to pay the costs themselves, as would often be the case if you had a promotion case or something else seeking injunctive relief. And the situation is aggravated a little bit in this particular case because there's really no guardian of the clients separate from this lawyer who's representing them. He himself is the guardian ad litem, so there's no client for him to discuss it with. That, of course, is not the defendant's fault, and I don't mean to criticize the plaintiff's counsel for an admirable job here. But this particular problem is partly of his own making in the way he chose to handle this case. But even so, a judgment has to be made on whether to accept a settlement offer in light of what he perceives to be the strength of the case and the client's overall best interest, not only in the relief sought in this case, but in the possibility that future representation can be secured for this class of clients if that becomes a serious problem.
Mr. Wallace, before you sit down, counsel for the respondent contends there's only one question properly before the court, and that's a waiver question. I take it from your argument that you believe the simultaneous negotiation question also is before this court.
Well, I thought the Ninth Circuit rested its decision on the impropriety of a simultaneous negotiation in this case.
Have you looked at the respondent's brief? Of course you have.
Yes. I'll let them, shape their argument as they see fit.
It's a very good brief, but doesn't it make the point that only the waiver issue is here?
As they argue their case,
yes.
But they are defending a judgment which is rested on the proposition that only in rare circumstances would simultaneous negotiation be permissible.
May I ask you one question, too, Mr. Wallace? You argue in substance here that the district court did not abuse its discretion by approving the settlement as was tendered to it. Would it have been within the district court's discretion to disapprove of the settlement within your judgment, simply, maybe not this particular, but simply on the ground that it made no allowance for fees at all and the plaintiffs obviously are entitled to something and the class has no resources with which to pay them? Would that ever be a permissible exercise of judgment, in your view, of discretion?
The circumstances, in our view, would have to be much more aggravated than is shown or alleged here.
Assuming they're quite aggravated.
Well, the hypothetical that I suggested would be a vindictive effort to try to deny legal representation for this class of persons in the future. By giving them an offer they can't refuse, in this case, contingent on a waiver in order to teach the attorneys a lesson.
Short of that, you'd say there's never discretion to disapprove a settlement.
Well, I don't see a source of it, Mr. Justice.
The court thought the fee was grossly exorbitant. The court would have a function then also?
Well, under Rule 23, it would have a concern with whether the attorney was favoring himself as against members of the class.
Very well. Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The basic issue here is whether Idaho's settlement offer made just 7 days before trial, which on the merits gave plaintiffs everything they had asked for, but demanded that they waive all counsel fees, created an inappropriate ethical situation for plaintiffs' counsel, and contravened the very purpose of the Civil Rights Act with respect to fees of 1976, which was to provide fees to prevailing plaintiffs to encourage private counsel to represent individuals seeking to vindicate constitutional rights.
Mr. Coleman.
Now, we've been...
Oh. Mr. Coleman, I take it that what you're saying would be just as true of an action brought under the Farmers and the Packers and Stockyards Act, Fair Labor Standards Act, where Congress has provided for attorney's fees.
Well, I'd have to look at the acts, Your Honor. The acts are different. But in this case, Congress made the judgment in 1976, after 2 years of investigation, that there were civil rights being violated. Most of the defendants were plaintiffs were poor people, and they couldn't get counsel.
Well, your response to me doesn't cite Merrick against Chesney, which we decided last June. In that case, we said, there is no evidence, however, that Congress, in considering Section 1988, had any thought that civil rights claims were to be on any different footing from other civil claims so far as settlement is concerned.
That's true, but I hope you would agree that if the state here had acted under Merrick and under Rule 68, filed this proposal as the judgment and said no counsel fees, I think you, Justice Powell, certainly in your concurring opinion in the Delta Airline case, and you, Your Honor, would say that an offer made in a civil rights case where all the defendant offered was an injunction, that would be an inappropriate offer under Rule 68 and would not bring Rule 68. And you, Mr. Justice Powell, said that under those circumstances, the court, if it accepted the judgment, would thereafter impose a reasonable counsel fee.
I repudiated in Merrick my statement in Delta.
Justice Powell, I think, has not yet repudiated, and I think that's clear. I think if you can't read Rule 68, which says that after 2.5 years of litigation, in a case where the plaintiffs resisted a motion for summary judgment, where they had all this discovery, where they wrote a pretrial conference memorandum, and the plaintiff's lawyer comes into court on March 22nd, ready to try the case. And at that point, the state says, I will give you everything you want, namely these children who in 1980, when this suit was started, were placed in facilities with adults, many of whom had been charged with sexually molesting children. The evidence makes it clear, if you look at page 64 and 65 of the record, that the state didn't even have a child psychiatrist. The state admits that these children being under these conditions actually were worse off. It also admits that if the state had discharged this responsibility, as you indicated that they should in the case out of Pennsylvania where you held that mentally held people had the right to get minimum treatment, that under those circumstances, these people would have been treated. At that point, when the plaintiff's lawyer, who had gotten everything he wanted, and the state knew, when this suit was filed, that the plaintiff's lawyers could not be paid by the plaintiffs, they were poor, they were indigent. They also knew there would never be a pot of money because this was for an injunction only. They also knew, because the Idaho Legal Aid Association gets federal funding, that under the federal statute, they cannot charge the plaintiff a fee. But yet, under your cases, if you're successful, they can get a counsel fee. And at those stages, what does the lawyer do? Can a lawyer look himself in the face and say, I've gotten all the relief for my client. If I reject it and I go to trial, even if I win, it will be 2 or 3 months later. It will be 1.5 years on appeal. My children during that time will continue to be raped.
Can I interrupt you with a question, Mr. Coleman? Yep. You asked what the plaintiff's counsel can do. Let me ask you what the defendant might do in the situation in which after a trial has gone on for about 90 days and they investigate it carefully and they say, by golly, they're right, we should make some changes here, and there's a $300,000 in our budget we can use that will cure up the problem, but we need the whole $300,000 to solve the problem. And the only way we can settle a case is if we get them to waive fees. if we have to put in $75,000 for fees, why, we just can't settle. What should the defendant's lawyer do?
Well, that didn't happen in this case.
Well, I know, but I mean, that's the kind of problem it seems to me we have to think
about. Well, what would happen would be that there would be negotiations, and if it's a fact that the state, after 3 months of trial, finally realizes since the day the complaint was filed they were violating the Constitution.
Well, I'm saying 3 months after a complaint is filed. Well, they study it, well, they say, I think
the facts in this case are very interesting. The plaintiff's lawyer here was responsible. When the lawsuit was filed and there was a claim against the educational defendants, those educational defendants acted just the way you suggested. After all, they were officers of the — they've taken an oath to defend the Constitution. They looked at the facts, and they immediately said, we will settle and we will give you what you wanted. And at that point, the plaintiff's counsel said, I will not claim a fee because you've acted responsibly. On the other hand, the Medill defendants said no. They resisted. They took you through every possible cause.
But why wasn't the same ethical problem presented to the plaintiff's lawyer at the first settlement proposal by the educational defendant?
Well, look, that's — now you put your finger on it, Mr. Justice Stevens. The court below misconstrued the ethical problem. The court below, on page 91 of the joint appendix, says that the ethical problem which it thought had been put before the court was whether a plaintiff, when he represents a plaintiff's lawyer, when he represents a plaintiff, can say, in this case, I won't charge a fee. Obviously, a plaintiff's lawyer can do that. But the ethical issue is just the opposite. Can the defense lawyer, under the facts of this case, tell the plaintiff's lawyer, I will give you everything you want, but you have to give up the statutory right which Congress gave you? And the plaintiff's lawyer, very responsible, he didn't back off. He said, at least put that before the judge.
Mr. Coleman, to what extent can state bar associations regulate this problem as a matter of ethics? I mean, why should we place some limitation on the ability to settle if these ethical dilemmas can be addressed appropriately by bar association requirements and regulations?
Well, Justice Carter, the problem is that does not take care of the part of the case where Congress, by statute, has says if you successfully settle a case, you're entitled to a counsel fee. The bar associations, to the extent
they've — Well, but of course, Merrick versus Chesney rather undercuts that argument, doesn't it?
I would disagree, Your Honor. It's clear when you reread Rule 68 that if the state had said, I agree that the damages is $100,000, and I file a statement under Rule 68, but there will be no counsel fees. At that point, I don't think Merrick versus Chesney would say that case is settled. The rule says you have to make the provision for costs, and now you, Judge Rehnquist, and you, Chief Justice, have said that includes counsel fees in the civil rights case. I think there it would not be an appropriate — you wouldn't have the problem. You only have the problem here because they didn't do that. But once again
— against Chesney was not the way you just hypothesized it. It wasn't that we'll pay you $100,000 but no attorney's fees. It was we'll pay you $100,000 for everything, and it's up to you to decide.
And the court below found that with respect to that, that what they got in settle — what after suit, the $50,000 — and that the counsel fees incurred prior to the time that the offer was made was only $32,000. So therefore, by arithmetic, $82,000 is less than $100,000. In that case, the defendant had made an appropriate offer. But if you had found, or the court below had found, that pre the tendering of the judgment, that counsel fees were $100,000, then you would have said, I hope, that under those circumstances, that was not an offer which complied with Rule 68.
Including some of our questions from the bench, that this is a matter for the organized bar to deal with, but how does it get to the organized bar?
Well, it so happened it would get to it. It so happens that the three organized bars that have looked at the situation have all said that it's inappropriate in this type of case for the defendant to make that type of offer.
I'm not talking about the generality, but the specific. Some party must bring the particular case to the attention of the Bar Association if there's to be an evaluation of the appropriateness of the particular case. Is that not so?
Oh, yes. But what's happened, Your Honor, this has come up. This is the latest ploy on the part of government to completely thwart civil rights lawyers. You bring a lawsuit, you do all the discovery. If you try the case, you're going to win. You're going to be entitled to counsel fees. They then put an offer before you which says, I'll give you everything you want. At that point, you know, in Brown, if before that case was argued, if the states have said to Mr. Justice Marshall, I'll give you everything you want, you will get a decree, word for word, the decree entered in 1955. At that point, anybody has to say, I will take that. But if in the meantime Congress had passed a statute saying that you're entitled to counsel fees, the state at that stage ought not to be able to thwart the counsel fees by saying, but you're not entitled to counsel fees. And I'd like to spend some time talking about what this case is not about, Your Honor. This case is not about simultaneous negotiation of fees. I ask you to read pages 23A and 25A to the appendix to the petition for cert, where the Ninth Circuit case is set forth. The judge says two times, we do not say that in all instances simultaneous bargaining of fees is improper. What we do say that on the facts of this case, this ought not to have happened. And Justice O'Connor, I think it is relevant that this is a class action. Suppose the other thing. Suppose the state had said,
Mr. Coleman, before you go on, the Court of Appeals did not adopt a per se rule. I agree with your reading of the opinion.
That's right.
But it went on to say that the rule in the Ninth Circuit was that there must be a showing of unusual circumstances. And it then proceeded to find that there were no such unusual circumstances in this case.
And they also cite a case where they approve the fee, even though it had been negotiated simultaneously.
But do you think that would be a proper rule, that there had to be a showing of unusual circumstances?
No, I think that's a separate question. I would certainly say that's not my case. I don't have to convince you that that the simultaneous rule is correct in
but you
order
might,
to
you
prevail
might have,
here.
You might have to, Mr. Coleman, if that issue also is here.
Well, if at the second, if you want to decide the case on two issues, then I will have to go to that. And I would certainly say I would urge you to reread the briefs of the Legal Defense Fund, the Bar Association of New York, and the other associations that are involved in this type of litigation. And they will tell you that what's happening today is creating havoc among those that are supposed to be representing in these cases, and that this is the ploy, and the fact that there are 44 attorney generals of the state here, the fact is the Solicitor General of the United States represented here, demonstrates that this is a way that the government feels it can thwart the 1976 Act.
Mr. Coleman, you say the simultaneous negotiation isn't here. I take it then that you think it's only the insistence upon a waiver of fees here that's here.
Well, actually, it was the original, under these circumstances, after 2.5 years of litigation,
yes,
this type of proposal.
Which but is to waive your fees.
Well, not quite, Your Honor.
Yes.
Even then, the plaintiff's lawyer, and indeed at that time, the defendant's lawyer, acted very responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at page 104 of the joint appendix and read paragraph 25, it says this is so if approved by the court. When it went before the court below, with all due respect to the judge, he misconstrued the issue.
Well,
he says the issue is whether plaintiff is acting improper.
But you don't, I take it you don't contend that the defendant's lawyer should not say to a plaintiff's lawyer, I want to make you an offer of settlement on the merits and also on your attorney's fees.
I would say that on the purpose, he could say that, and he could say, how many hours have you spent? What's your hourly rate? And he did not make any. This is, you give it all up. This is not a case which says, I think you only should get $10,000. I should think you should only get $25,000. This is a case where he says nothing. Well, he says that after 2.5 years of litigation, your cases have held that if you settle a case, you're entitled to counsel fee. And even then, and I repeat this, he didn't just let it stay there. He said, well, why don't we put it to the judge? And the judge misconstrued what was put to him.
Well, suppose the defendant's lawyer says, here's an offer on the merits and here's an offer of your attorney's fees. And they negotiate back and forth, and the plaintiff's lawyer finally agrees on both. And then the settlement is approved, except that the plaintiff's lawyer then says, it was unfair. It was unfair. It put me in a bad spot, and I think I should have an additional award of fees.
Well, that's not this case, Your Honor. I'd give you the other case. I just asked you.
How about my case?
And Justice O'Connor, I read, because this is a class action. Yeah. If the agreement had been that the fee paid should have been $25,000, mm-hmm. the judge, under the class action rules, would have to look at it. Mm-hmm. And if the judge said, no, I think the reasonable fee is $10,000, the one thing is clear that the plaintiff's lawyer could not say, well, under those circumstances, Your Honor, forget the settlement, I'll try the case.
But what if the plaintiff's lawyer says, look, Judge, go ahead and approve the settlement on the merits, but I think I'm entitled to a hearing on what a reasonable fee would be?
Well, we think under the 1976 statute and under the class action rules, Rule 23, at that point, the federal district judge has the responsibility of setting a reasonable fee.
So the fact that the plaintiff signed a settlement on his fee should not bar the judge from setting another fee.
I think the judge clearly has a duty to look at it. And the judge certainly would take into consideration that what the amount suggested. But after 2.5 years of litigation,
it's more than suggested. It's what they both agreed
yeah,
to.
Yeah, what they agreed to, that he would consider that as one of the factors.
Yes, right.
And particularly when you consider it, as I understand the cases, when if it's too much, the judge has a duty to adjust it downward.
Then a defendant in a case subject to the 1976 Act, if he wants to concede a single issue on the merits, is bound to pay some attorney's fees. Is that
well,
right?
Well, the 1976 Act says...
Well, could you answer yes or
well,
no?
Well, the answer is, Your Honor, I can tell you what the statute says. The statute says the court may award, and it is highly possible, and this goes to the frivolous claim, that's the reason why I just can't say yes or no. If the judge makes a determination that this was a frivolous claim, and therefore for nuisance reasons it was settled for $1,000 or something like that, then I don't think the judge has to pay the fee. But the judge has to look at it. He has to exercise.
Supposing that the plaintiff brings 10 different claims, and the defendant says, I don't think 9 of them are any good, but I'll stipulate to relief on the 10th. Does that mean that the court, under your view, is going to automatically be able to award attorney's fees?
The court would consider it, and I'm pretty sure the judge would reread Justice Powell's opinion in Hensley, which says that you have to consider the facts. And there are 12 factors set forth, and in those cases, Justice Powell has made clear that if you have 6 claims, you win 5 of them and lose on 1, that the court can take that into consideration.
But Hensley was a case that was tried, I believe. I'm talking about a case that settled before trial.
Well, the case that came out of the Second Circuit, which held that you could get counsel fees even though the case was settled, says that you have the right to get counsel fees. And I think that it's something the judge would look at. I mean, if what you're saying, Your Honor, if you file the lawsuit and the day after you file, there's a settlement, that obviously that's different from a case where you have 2.5 years litigation. It depends upon the fact, and this Court has made it clear that in each case, the judge has the responsibility of looking. And we say here he had the responsibility because of the Act of 1976. He had the responsibility because this was a Rule 23 proceeding. And he had the responsibility because paragraph 25 said that it was subject to his approval. And he misread his obligation at that point, and he never tried to prove the case.
Stipulation of the two counsel cannot foreclose the trial court's exercise of discretion.
I would say that the stipulation of two counsel cannot completely foreclose the child judge's discretion in a Rule 23 case and in a case where Congress has a statute which specifically says that people are entitled to counsel fees.
Well, what if this were not a Rule 23 case? We're not a class action. Would the judge still have the power to approve the settlement, in your view?
If it were
just an individual claim, three or four people sued for damages or injunctive relief.
Is it a civil rights suit?
Civil rights suit, but not a class action.
Well, under
what
those
would be the source of the judge's authority to disapprove a settlement?
Well, it wouldn't come about that way, Your Honor. What it would come about, there'd be a settlement.
Well, but the settlement is that I'll offer to pay or to give something, buy a Cadillac for your client, say, and I won't give you anything in fees. And they says I'll agree to it. The client says I'd rather have the Cadillac than the job. Can the judge interfere with that settlement?
Well, the judge cannot. At that point, the answer is no, Your Honor, but
and no fees to the lawyer. No fees to the lawyer.
Well, in addition, Your Honor, you realize that once that happens, your cases have said at that point there arises a cause of action which you never had before, namely to file a motion under the 1976 Act. And at that time, the
but
judge
even if
would,
the settlement agreement says in so many words, I had the plaintiff waive any claim to fees, and that's the condition of the settlement. You say that nevertheless, the lawyer has a suit for fees.
No, I don't know. I would say that the plaintiff has a suit under the Act. That doesn't mean he's going
to
win.
I understand your position in the class action setting, but I have a lot of difficulty knowing how to move from that into the individual.
Well, the individual case is a harder case. I mean, I have two or three strings to my bow. I lose one in the private action, but I still say that what happens is, well, it's quite clear, if they settle the case privately and said nothing about counsel fees, it's clear that under the Act of 1976, you're entitled to get counsel fees. If
Mr. Coleman. Bowman, you may resume.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the Court, this case is not about the defendant's lawyer being able to complain that he was misled or that he was mistaken, that the plaintiffs were not going to make a claim for counsel fee. And contrary to what General Jones said, the plaintiff's lawyer could not have rejected the fee and tried the case because he'd received in the offer everything he would have gotten as a result of the trial. It's not about frivolous lawsuits, and there are plenty of remedies to take care of that. In this case, the Court must apply the 1976 Act in the settlement and the Rule 23 context. In conclusion, I speak here in furtherance of the inherent decency in our society which free people worldwide admire. Despite over 200 years of glorious successes, there still are poor people in this country whose constitutional rights are violated, who have no resources to pay for lawyers. Unfortunately, the legal profession has not developed in the tradition of Abraham Lincoln, who, as Carl Sandburg tells us in Lincoln's Perry Years, one day represented the Illinois Central for an enormous fee, and the next day represented an impoverished criminal defendant for $5. Today, successful private practitioners often do not devote any time to representation of the poor who cannot afford to pay fees. Congress recognized this problem in the civil rights context and opted to handle it in a particular way. It did not create a governmental bureaucracy where poor people could go to have their cause prosecuted conscientiously by a government employee. It did not set up a voucher system in which the government would pay the private lawyer win, lose, or draw. Nor did it create a system in which the poor could select a private lawyer and have the government pay the lawyer if he prevailed, as is the case with the Special Prosecutor's Act, under which high public officials get their fees paid by the government if they are successful. Instead, Congress placed the task of representing indigent civil rights plaintiffs upon private lawyers, many of whom are young and not employed by the large law firms who can absorb the cost. This court must not permit the states and the federal government to block their one chance to receive compensation at the end of a difficult litigation. We should admire, not penalize, the lawyers at Idaho Legal Aid who recognize their responsibility to accept a favorable merits settlement rather than take selfish action to protect their fees. It is a sad day if this court penalizes such ethical and gracious acts. And this is not an issue that you can leave to the Bar Association because, for good or worse, Congress has placed the responsibility on the courts since it enacted the Act of 1976.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
It's too bad.